Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What new insights can be uncovered when a 21st century composer creates a brand new score for a nearly century-old silent film? As part of its debut season, the Dallas Chamber Symphony commissioned Austin composer Brian Satterwhite to write scores for two enduring classics of the silent era, A Sailor Made Man, which was performed last fall, and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which will debut tonight at the Dallas City Performance Hall. Joining us to talk about the project and about the place for a chamber symphony in the broader North Texas arts community are Brian Satterwhite and Richard McKay, who is artistic director and conductor of the Dallas Chamber Symphony. Richard, Brian, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here. It's very exciting.
So for people who have not seen The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, the first thing to know is that it is widely considered the first horror film ever, right?
Generally speaking, it depends on who you ask. There were definitely horror elements in cinema prior to that. Georges Méliès did some very nightmarish scenery in his filmmaking in the 1890s. And even Thomas Edison experimented with some fairly dark scenery in some of his early films. But when you look at what we now consider as the modern horror film, it definitely got its start from The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It was a feature-length nightmare, essentially, put to film. And that was something that was brand new for audiences back when this was made in 1919.
What kind of music would have been performed live to accompany a film like that at the time that it first came out?
Back in those days, it was largely... There were several approaches, largely improvised. So you would have a film running, you would have a pianist or an organist, a single person improvising live to picture. It was right around that time they did start to actually compose music, but so much of that has been lost. There was an original composer attached to Caligari, but as far as I know, that score does not exist. Nobody knows what it is he has written. At least I have not come across it. I think it's been lost over time. They just didn't take steps to preserve those types of things back then.
Wouldn't you love to hear it and compare it to what you've created?
Most definitely. And this is a pretty famous film, and I have heard other renditions, other composers who have put their touch on it. And so it's just a huge playground for a composer to do some very creative things and just really have fun. It's a wonderful film to approach from a multiple score angle.
So, Richard, why did you want the film score series to be part of the debut season for the Chamber Symphony? And what made you think, okay, Brian Satterwhite is the guy to do it?
To take those questions out of order, the reason I wanted to work with Brian, we had worked together back when I was at school at UT Austin. We had worked on a music theater production and just a community music theater production, and he was just so solid as a composer. He was he was time effective. He delivered everything on time. These things are so important when you're doing a newly commissioned work. You have to have things delivered on time. The scores have to be very well prepared. They also just have to be good. And they have to be the kind of thing that audience members could relate to very well and appreciate very easily. And so when I was looking for someone who I knew could help us get through the technological aspects of producing a film score series like this, I knew Brian would be the guy to get us through it. Also, as far as having film scores as a part of our initial season, there is a model for doing this sort of thing nationally. And so, I had looked at other orchestras, Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, for example. It's just a very popular thing right now, and it's trending. We were talking about this yesterday over lunch. We were talking about how this phenomenon of silent film to new scores is really picking up speed, but it's not done everywhere yet. And mm-hmm.
It's still relatively rare. So to have it here in Dallas is a special thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's one of those areas because, there's plenty of chamber music going on all over the place at universities. And so we were looking at ways to have a very unique product at least several times a year, unlike what anyone else is doing. And so the film aspect was key to setting a brand for ourselves early on.
So I would imagine that when you're scoring any film, even, you know, the ones that were up for Academy Awards this weekend, there's this question about the extent to which the music should draw attention to itself or should be sort of an atmospheric element. And I would imagine there are places where you want it to draw attention and not. But talk about the discussions maybe that you both had together as the process went on. Or was this kind of a solo thing as you worked on it, Brian, and then you gave it to Richard and said, it's done?
I mean, it was fairly much the latter. Richard gave me a lot of trust and creative freedom to do what I wanted to do. But at the same time, we, especially early on, the ensemble itself was given to me by Richard. He told me, he didn't give me much criteria, but he basically said, this is going to be your instrumentation, and basically to compose a score for that particular instrumentation. And that actually went a long way for, especially with Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, of me deciding that film. Because he told me before I even picked the film, he said, you're going to be composing for all strings on that concert. So I said, all strings, okay. That limits a lot of the possibilities of what I could possibly do as it comes to a film. And when you have all strings, that lent itself to maybe something darker, something of the horror genre element. And so I went through a few horror films. Caligari was definitely tops on the list, and I, when I thought I had picked it, I went through some other films.
Nosferatu.
There's some old early Lon Chaney film that I thought of, and but when I came back to Caligari, I said, it's so iconic, it's so famous, and with A Sailor Made Man, the score that I did in November, it was the exact opposite. That was a comedy, a film that I didn't think many people, if any, would have ever seen it because it's a fairly rare film. But on the flip side of that, I knew that some people in the audience tonight will have seen Caligari, and I wanted them to at least have an audience that had some people who had seen it and familiarized already with it.
And the plot elements are really interesting. I mean, for anyone who saw like Shutter Island a few years ago, there are some similar. I think in some ways it feels so contemporary because it's dealing with the nature of sanity or madness and
exactly.
One's perception of things. And how did that color the way you used strings to reveal the mood, and did that play into, I guess you had decided you wanted strings, Richard, from the beginning, regardless of what the film would be.
That's true. You know, we had set out our full season, and I mean, not only are there artistic things that we're considering as far as programming, but just logistical things, how many players, cost, all of these things,
sure.
These pragmatic issues. We were setting those out very early on, and so that's how we knew that. But it's interesting you mentioned Shutter Island. We're also in the hall tonight using some electronic music, Ingram Marshall from Shutter Island, that was used in that film score as people enter the hall. It's called Fog Tropes, and it's interesting how you bring up that contemporary element. I feel very strongly that this film does feel very contemporary when you watch it. The score certainly is. And also some of these horror elements that you see in these other films that are electronic and very contemporary. It's just a perfect accent to the evening.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not to be taken lightly either. This film was kind of way ahead of its time. And by our standards, it still holds up. These psychological elements that we're so used to in modern film could be traced all the way back to this particular movie. And I think that's what makes it so important in the canon of when you're looking at film literature as a whole.
Does it feel very German when you watch it in terms of its outlook? And we should say post-World War I German, which was a kind of a troubling time.
I would say yes, just because I'm aware of that, you know, the German expressionism that was going on at that time. I mean, Caligari is an exemplar of German expressionism. But having said that, are modern audiences going to look at this and feel anything particularly German about it if they're not familiar with that movement? I don't necessarily think so. I mean, these are classic themes, reoccurring themes that we've seen in various films. I don't think there's anything else that just reeks German about it. It's just a good old-fashioned nightmarish story.
Are you looking at this part of the debut season, Richard, to draw in maybe younger audience members who don't think of themselves as chamber symphony devotees?
I'd say so, yes. I mean, just looking at our audience, what we can see from our patron rosters and the research we've done about the people who come to our concerts, we find out that they are actually quite young. And just that demographic from, I'd say, college-age students to about mid-40s, approaching 50, that's where the bulk of our audience is. And so many people in our audience, these are people who don't have a tremendous amount of symphonic experience. Mm-hmm. And if they're anything like me, when I was very young, for example, you know, my window into the symphonic world first was through film. I mean, I experienced John Williams. I experienced all of those great film scores. And it was, you know, when you're in a world where symphonic music isn't front and center in most people's lives, that really is the gateway, the film where you can see the symphonic genre thriving in everyday life. And so when I could hear those scores and get a sense of just the colorations and the palette that they used, that's what hooked me. And then what you quickly find is that so much of John Williams, for example, might sound like Strauss or mm-hmm. Holst, and you can branch out from there and you go off to college, you study music, you start finding new music that you love, you start to see its influence on the film that you've always loved. And so it is a perfect gateway for those people to find a way into the symphonic world.
And I was going to say, and that's, there's an analogy there with the film at the same time. I mean, I do think this is a very attractive experience for everybody, including younger people. And it goes back to a story, a memory that I had when I was in junior high school, and we'd taken a band trip to Richmond, Virginia. I was in the band, and one of the things on our schedule during this overnight weekend trip to Richmond was to go to this old-time theater and listen to a live score with a silent picture. It was a Buster Keaton film called The General. I'll never forget it. That's another classic film that's excellent. And it was one of those humongous organs that rise up out of the stage, and there was a player that came on, and he improvised on this humongous organ live to picture. Well, as a junior high school kid, you know, whatever, silent film, it's old. I wasn't that interested. It was like it just didn't it was something to do, but I wasn't really that excited about it. But having left that experience, it utterly blew me away to be able to experience this idea that a live score was going on with a classic American silent film. And my goal for both of these scores is exactly that. It's less about the music that I've written, and regardless who has written the music, the opportunity to see this film with a live score is, I'm hoping to blow people's minds because of the movie, because the movie is so cool, and there's not a lot of opportunity to deliver these silent films to audiences. You can go on Netflix, you can watch The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It's not the same. It's not even close. And I love silent film, but it's not the same to just sit at home and watch a silent film. To be able to go into a hall and see it with live musicians is the only way to experience it.
When you talk, Richard, about building a core audience of younger people, that enthusiasm is amazing. That passion for what you're doing can be great. We know that every marketer in the world wants this, you know, sort of target audience that you just mentioned. What they don't have is money, which is something that I know particularly a new arts organization needs.
That's true. And that I must admit, you know, most of our financial supporters are not young. They do not fit in that demographic. That's absolutely true. I don't know that there are too many ways around that. I'd say the reason we've attracted such a young audience is generally because our musicians are also young. They're well connected to that community. We're well connected to local universities, so we do get a lot of those students. We do offer quite a lot in the way of incentives for students as well. So that really drives in a very young audience, but they do tend to travel more. They do tend to move around more. And so it's probably not the best strategy for a long-term building of an orchestra. I think that what sustains us over the long term, and you know, we look for donors just like everyone else, but we're always scouting them out, and they're, I'd say, just as an important part of our organization as anyone else.
We are speaking this hour with Richard McKay, who's artistic director and conductor of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. Brian Satterwhite is here as well. He's composer of the new score for The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari that premieres as a concert of the Dallas Chamber Symphony tonight at the Dallas City Performance Hall. We'll come back to the conversation in just a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
That is the Dallas Chamber Symphony performing an excerpt from Roadrunner, the third movement of Chamber Symphony by American composer John Adams. We're speaking this hour with the artistic director and conductor of the Dallas Chamber Symphony, Richard McKay, and also with Brian Satterwhite, composer of the new score for The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which the Dallas Chamber Symphony will premiere tonight as a concert at the Dallas City Performance Hall, along with a screening of the 1919 film. You can join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Brian, I'm curious about the tradition of the way that, extemporaneous scores would have been composed on the fly by people working in theaters all over the world, working, I guess, with a piano or an organ typically. Mm-hmm. How much of that did you have in your mind, and did you sort of begin thinking right away about the sounds you wanted, or did you watch the film multiple times? What was your process for deciding what you wanted to create?
Every film I approach is different, and I think having that flexibility is what goes into, I think, being good at this particular job, because the film will tell you everything that you need to know in order to serve it, in order to give it the music that it needs to become a good film. It's with Caligari, it was a very different experience for me than anything else I had worked on. I was not thinking about any other musical style or any other composer or anything that I've heard previously. I rarely do. In fact, everything that dictated the direction that I took came from the film itself, and most specifically the visuals. If you watch Caligari, its most iconic qualities are the visual elements of the film. It's extremely disoriented. All of the angles are jagged and slanted. There's not a perpendicular line or a 90-degree angle anywhere in the movie. So it's this very disoriented, sharp contrast, high blacks, low whites, that kind of experience. And so I basically just began creating music that complemented or mirrored that visual, those visual qualities. And in a way, I felt more like a painter or an illustrator rather than a composer, because I'm using dark and light and these jagged edges. The main theme has equally jagged shape to it. And so it was mostly just a visual response. And again, I wasn't really too concerned about those other elements, again, style. The way that I describe the music itself is I want to deliver a fresh experience rooted in nostalgia. I think that's how I approach Sailor Maid Man as well. So I'm not mimicking or aping anything from the past. I want it to be fresh, but I don't want to be completely off the wall either. I'm not trying to create something groundbreaking or new. I want it to be rooted in a feeling of nostalgia at the same time.
How did you, Richard, want the musicians who will be performing tonight to prepare in terms of their familiarity with the material visually that would go along with what they're playing?
That's a great question, and it might surprise most people to know that the musicians stay pretty far away, I think, from the visual process. It's interesting what they go through. They get these parts probably about 2 weeks in advance or so, their practice parts. But it looks and reads just like any other kind of music. It's cut into cues, and so they're just accustomed to playing these movements to film. But I think the preparation for the visual aspect is primarily my job. job as the conductor, because what I look at in my score, I see as empty times, I see punches, and I see just cues, these streamers that move across a monitor screen, a computer right in front of me as I conduct the score. And so I can look at that monitor, I can read my score at the same time, and I can align what happens in the score to what happens with the visual cues on my monitor, which then aligns to the video that's being projected up over the orchestra. So, that's what I'm thinking about when I go into the performance. But as far as the musicians, they would play it down just like any other piece. They just have to follow very closely to make sure that as we come up to those really hard arrivals, that they're perfectly in sync with them.
It sounds like an incredibly complicated process to, from your perspective, to keep track of everything. Is it just a matter of learning, almost like driving, to put your eyes here and put your eyes there? And obviously, you're listening the whole time. And how do you, with the added element of precise cues, visual cues that have to be matched, how do you get in practice to do that?
Well, I spend some time just working with the software program, watching those cues, seeing where they align with the film. The great thing that we're doing, rather than using a rigid click track that might dictate the beats as we go along, we're using punches and streams on a monitor. And what this does is it allows us a tremendous amount of flexibility musically. So I can take a little time with a phrase. I can move forward. I can pull back. But I can see in my score what's coming up, and then I can, pace us so that we get there at the arrival at the right time. I'd say generally in the performance, I try to pay most attention to what the next very important arrival is. I try to bend the time a little bit so that it sounds musical. You can hear those phrases breathing. You don't have to play it metronomically the whole time. And yet you can have those perfect times, those perfect arrivals that just, will raise the hairs on your arm.
We early on in the process, one of the conversations that we had before we began is how do we do that? How do we put it to picture? And again, like you mentioned, the two ways to do that is using this punches and streamers process, or we could have used a click track. A click track would have made things just infinitely easier because all the musicians and the conductor just have a metronomic click in their earphones, and as long as they stay with that click, they know they're going to stay with the picture. However, it's not musical, and for a live performance, I wanted the flexibility of being musical, of having these phrases breathe as they're coming out, and so he agreed with that, and we decided to go. It's more technically challenging, and the performance, it adds a challenge to it, but it for the audience, it's a better experience.
And it's interesting also just from the matter of process, when things occur, it's interesting that the synchronization to film is always the last thing to occur.
Yeah.
And in fact, the last concert, it's the most important thing, you would think. If it's not in sync, it's crazy. But even at the last concert, it's amazing how late that process happens. I mean, it was our dress rehearsal that we were still ironing out all the technical things and putting that software to the film and learning how to start it so that everything's synchronized so that it just flows. Because once you start it, you're set until the end of the film. You cannot stop. There's no way.
The train's gone, as I put it.
That's right. And so that always happens at the dress rehearsal right before the concert.
What about volume? I mean, how do you think about using that as a tool as you're conducting to this particular set of visual images?
That volume is extremely important, I think, and especially the balance of the ensemble, because what we're accustomed to when we watch film now with these film scores, these scores that we hear are very well engineered. They are processed audio, and so you get these very dry sounds. You get the perfect transparent orchestra played at exactly the right volume to the film.
They're hyper-realized, as I put it. It's not natural to hear these. Sound does not exist on recording anywhere in the natural world,
And the wonderful thing about doing silent film is that I don't have to worry about processing the audio or it being too loud, because you're not going to cover up audio from, actors, the dialogue. So the silent film really gives us a pretty blank slate. I mean, we can afford to do almost anything we want with volume, but that does get immensely more complex as we start to bring in other elements like actors who are speaking dialogue.
Yeah.
When I go to an orchestra performance, one of the pleasures for me is actually watching the musicians at work. Are there places where it will be easy to sort of pull their eyes down from the screen and look at the musicians?
I think that's going to be up to the audience. I'm I know exactly what you're talking about, and there will be a temptation to watch the performers. And I think that's part of the joy of the experience. I don't think that takes away from the film per se. I mean, the intention is to watch the movie and enjoy it. But I know audiences are going to glance down because it's cool. You remind yourself, like, wow, this is being performed live. Mm-hmm. And I know we've talked about this last time as well, is that a lot of people are going to be glancing at his computer monitor, because there obviously the picture is going to be blown up on a huge screen above the orchestra, but then on Richard's podium is his computer monitor with the film and those punches and streamers that guide him along the way. And some people are going to glance at that and think that's pretty cool too.
It's clumsy imagery, and I don't mean to discount what you do. It's almost like an elephant dancing on a ball, like the many things that you have to have in balance and in sync to make this work.
I told them last time, and I told the orchestra this too last time, so they could understand how difficult this is. It's like the film is conducting Richard, and then Richard has to then conduct the orchestra. Mm-hmm. So you have to worry about things getting lost in translation through that, because it's not a natural process to have somebody conduct somebody else to conduct the orchestra.
I have to imagine that the musicians are really excited to perform things that haven't been done before.
That's absolutely true. Our musicians are so enthused typically about playing the concerts that we do. That excerpt you played of the John Adams Chamber Symphony, it's extremely rare that a local musician would get to play something like that. Partially because it's a very bold pick, an artistic pick for a concert. It's not exactly, you know, Beethoven Symphony. So, you know, people aren't going to recognize it on the program. They might be less inclined to come to concerts when they don't know what they're going to hear. But certainly musicians, professional musicians who are routined in playing those Beethoven Symphonies and routined in playing certain operas or whatnot, when they have that opportunity to sink their teeth into a new score like the Chamber Symphony, they get so excited. And when they can also have this fun process of setting a new score to film, you know, it's a world premiere when we do these things. It's always a delight.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email us at think@kera.org. We're talking this hour to Richard McKay, Artistic Director and Conductor of the Dallas Chamber Symphony, and Brian Satterwhite, composer of the new score for the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which will be performed tonight. It's the premiere at the Dallas City Performance Hall. We have an email here from Rick in Fort Worth who wants to know, will the screen aspect of the program be light through film or digital projection?
It's a digital projection, yeah. I mean, I understand one's appeal to film, and that would certainly be an added touch of greatness. But just for the logistics and technology side of this whole process and how difficult it is, it will be a digital projection.
What condition is the print in that exists, the original print that still exists?
It's about as good as you could hope for this 94-year-old film that has gone through a lot. I mean, you will see some damage to the picture itself at certain times. That can't be helped. There has been a few companies out there who have taken it and really given it a lot of attention, a lot of care, and have restored it to the best that it could possibly exist. And that is essentially what we're going to be seeing tonight. But that doesn't mean it's flawless. It's a 94-year-old movie, so there's definitely going to be some artifacts of age.
Well, I have to imagine there's some appeal to that, too, because it feels real.
I think so, and that's what part of the charm of a silent film is. I mean, you realize how old these movies are, and again, the limitations that they had in creating these movies, and yet they were still able to do such magical things on screen. It's a cool experience, and my favorite thing about this process is the fact that I can have the opportunity to deliver silent film to a new audience. I mean, that's the most exciting thing. I really hope that they walk away with an appreciation for it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Mike on the line in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hello. I had a question about composing for film. And what kind of training does one need to be able to mirror in music what's going on the screen, such as dark images, dark sounds, and another sort of stock musical or theoretical devices like minor and diminished sounds?
That's a good question. It varies from composer to composer. Everybody's going to have a different story on kind of how they gain their experience and their knowledge. For me personally, I actually went to school and got a degree in it. I went to Berklee College of Music up in Boston, Massachusetts. And at the time I went, I still believe this is true to this day, it was only one of three schools in the world that you could actually get a degree in how to write music for movies. And that was the choice that I made. It was a personal choice of mine. I get people ask me all the time, I want to be a film composer. Do I have to go get a degree in it? My answer is no. I mean, definitely not, because everybody has a different way in which they gain experience and knowledge. For me, the best way, it was important for me to get a degree. So I went to college and actually majored in it.
Did they teach you anything about communicating with people who are not musicians, who may be in charge of the films?
Of course. In fact, that's a big, big part of my job of being successful, because you can't just speak music language to people that don't know music. That doesn't do anybody any good. And most directors I've worked with don't know music to that extent. So I'm always, one of the first things I do when I meet a new director for the first time is I try to put their mind at ease. Look, don't feel like you have to speak with me using musical language that you don't know. You speak to me in your language, which is cinema and storytelling, and I'll convert that to music. So, and that usually puts a lot of people at ease. But yeah, you're right. It's you have to learn, and I say this to every young up-and-coming composer, communication is the absolute most important skill a film composer must have to succeed.
It would seem like, is communication a natural skill for musicians in general because you use music to communicate, or is it a sort of a different set of skills, verbal communication and musical communication?
Gosh, you know, I think communication is a challenge for many musicians. I think that we tend to have this ivory tower sort of philosophy about music. We spend so much time in these institutions like public universities or conservatories. It's so easy to pull yourself away from the people who ultimately will be your patrons. And it's extraordinary how rare it is that you get professors in these same audiences coming to maybe an orchestra concert and even other students. So what ends up being very important later on, as soon as you graduate and you get out into the field and start working with others, you start to feel that need to relate with regular people who speak different languages all the time. And they just love music. They love it so much. They want it to be such a big part of their lives. But they are using different words all the time to say the things that, you know, we just might take for granted.
We're speaking this hour with Richard McKay, Artistic Director and Conductor of the Dallas Chamber Symphony, and Brian Satterwhite, composer of the new score for The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari that premieres tonight as a concert of the Dallas Chamber Symphony at the Dallas City Performance Hall. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Richard McKay of the Dallas Chamber Symphony and Brian Satterwhite, who composed the new score for The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari that will be performed as a concert tonight by the Dallas Chamber Symphony at the Dallas City Performance Hall. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Richard, were you signed on to perform at the Dallas City Performance Hall before it was completed?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we discovered that space rather late, but I think it was as early as about October of the year before it opened. So about a year before you know it was ready to go, we had already, you know, put ourselves in the queue so that we could bid for dates, and we had our whole season lined up. So it was an interesting process just starting up the orchestra, because we had to find that perfect space naturally. And prior to City Performance Hall, there really was not a good place to perform chamber music in the Arts District.
Given the size of the orchestra.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the size of the space also, because as much as chamber music is about smaller orchestras and, it's small ensembles like even trios or quartets, it's as much about the space. Mm-hmm. In fact, the chamber refers to the space. It is a smaller space. It is a more intimate space. It's where you sit closer to the musicians. It's where each musician is more soloistic in the sense you can hear every part through the texture, and so every musician really has to take ownership of that sound. And so when we did see, we were looking at other venues that maybe sat 200-300 or so just around the community, but when we found out that hall was being built, we got in the queue, and then we finally walked through the hall. I think it was in April or something of last year, and this was just several months before we launched our first concert, which was, the first orchestral concert there at the hall. And
any anxiety before that first walkthrough? The first time you practiced there?
Absolutely. The walkthrough was what convinced us it was perfect. We left there so excited, and truly, it was that day that we all said we have to do this, and we'll never get a perfect hall like this.
I remember
again.
You sent me an email right away, and you were just beaming. Yeah.
Did they have like a piano up there for you to like listen to sound, or how did you test the acoustics?
Well, we didn't test the acoustics until we moved in the day before our first concert. Actually, the way it happened. That first walkthrough was hard hats. It was not finished. Mm-hmm. And truly, the final touches weren't put on the hall until just weeks before our first performance there. So when we did finally move in, we discovered very quickly that you can't set the orchestra too far upstage because it just sounds awful. So mm-hmm. we shuffled around at our rehearsal, and the next thing we found some positions that did work, and the acoustician was there working with us very graciously. That whole process, they were adjusting the curtains, they were adjusting everything in that hall to make it to make it work, and it ended up working quite well.
And it should be noted that this hall is about the most perfect space I've come across for these live silent film scores. Because I have seen events like this that are held in, like, let's say, a movie theater that just don't quite have the acoustical charm that a hall has. And I've seen them in large symphonic halls where the film tends to get swallowed up in the space. But the City Performance Hall is the right size. The acoustics are great. You can sit anywhere, and you feel like you're connected with the film. I'm totally jealous because it might be one of my new favorite buildings, especially for hearing music and for these live film score presentations.
With all due respect, it's great to hear a musician from Austin say, "I envy Dallas."
Yeah,
I am when it comes to this because it's special. Again, we mentioned earlier, yes, this is trending, but I would say it's still rare and. Mm-hmm. And just to have an ensemble committed to bringing these types of events on a yearly basis is not to be taken lightly.
We have an email here from Carol in Dallas who wants to know, is tonight's performance the only one?
It is. Mm-hmm. In fact, all of our performances are that way. We are a new ensemble here on the scene, so we are looking to expand our offerings, maybe to have two or three per show. But right now, it's a one-and-off thing, so make sure you come.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Matt in Fort Worth. Hi, Matt.
Hello. So my question, it may be legend, but, Pink Floyd's album, The Dark Side of the Moon, was a brilliant album in its own right, but legend has it that it matches with the Wizard of Oz score. I guess my question is, or matches with the movie, and some of the elements coincide musically with elements in the movie. I'm curious if maybe you've ever considered performing the more contemporary shows or music, and furthermore, whether you'd ever considered doing scores to movies that weren't silent.
Thanks for your call.
It's interesting, yeah. I've actually seen a screening of Wizard of Oz with the Pink Floyd album, and yes, for about the length of the album, which is not the entire length of the film, it does tend to match up. I do believe it's totally by accident. Mm-hmm. As somebody who works in the field, and I've placed music into various films just to see how things work, and it's amazing how there are many happy accidents out there, and you'll find a piece of music just miraculously kind of fit this film, even though it was not intended for that. But so I think that's probably just coincidence, although it is a very cool experience to sit and watch. But I know, Richard, you've talked about doing some more contemporary film presentations and things like that. If you want to...
Sure. I mean, we're talking about all sorts of experimentation and ways to build the film score program. There are so many ways, and even in our early discussions, we had just about everything on the table as far as what we were going to do with film, whether it was going to be traditional, whether it was going to be contemporary, whether it would be this silent film angle where we would take these full features and build new scores for them, or if we might take kind of a variety show of different things and put music to those. But we are going to be experimenting more and more in the future, working as much in film as probably in music at the same time, blending, modern elements, continuously.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Mark on the line now in Athens. Hey, Mark.
Hi there. I'm really, really enjoying today's conversation. I don't really have a question or a comment, just an anecdote. Back in July of 68, I was a cadet at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, and I was on a ship in Calcutta, India. And one evening, I went ashore and went to a little bitty movie theater and saw Charlie Chaplin's The Kid.
Yeah.
This was presented as a silent film. There was a couple dozen people in there. The price of a ticket was 1 rupee, which is about 10 cents value at that time, which is a day's wage for a basic working person. And that means only probably middle-class folks could go there, but it was just a wonderful experience sitting seeing the movie as it was originally presented.
Yeah, and that goes down to the magic of this era. I mean, it's largely neglected, I think, especially by modern audiences, that they just... I'll admit, silent films are hard to appreciate in a modern context, and that's why an event like this is, when you get the opportunity to experience it in its most purest and perfect way, it's an opportunity that shouldn't be missed.
So, obviously, there is the applause when the performance is over. I'll assume there's going to be copious applause. During the performance itself, how are you – I don't know how – if you can do it at all, Richard, while you're focused on everything, on balancing on your elephant ball as you are. but how do you – are there ways that the audience breathes, that they move, that they shift in their seats or don't, that tell either one of you that something – that a particular section is really working and another one is something you would have changed had you been able to do so?
Well, I remember just the feeling from the last performance we did in November. It was very special when we finally performed it. I mean, we had been through the score a number of times, and we had set it to film in the rehearsals and got a sense of how that was going to play out. But certainly when the audience got in there, it didn't take long at all. I mean, it was in those first couple of minutes when people were starting to laugh at the antics on screen, and that was such a relief. I remember when I felt it, because it just felt like it was working.
And that was my moment, too. I had made an introduction prior to the start of the show, and I was actually going around off stage and going around the back when the concert started. And I stood in the back of the hall during the first minute, and the credits are rolling and they're playing. And there's the first comedy gag is that came up in that film. I stood in the back just kind of holding my breath and a little tense, and I was waiting for that first gag. And when the first gag came and the whole audience erupted in laughter, I knew I had them. Mm-hmm. So I was like, after that, I had no more worries. I had no more. When they laughed at that first moment, I knew I had them.
Any concerns with Caligari that there are things that are unintentionally funny to a modern audience, just based on the style of acting back then or the visual imagery used, that sort of thing?
Well, I think that's always possible. I'm just going through the film myself. I don't think so.
Nothing jumps out at you.
Nothing jumps out. If the audience happens to find something that's particularly funny and laugh, I don't think that detracts from anything. It's a different experience for everybody, and that's fine. But based on the music that I've composed and the film itself, I don't know if that'll be an expected reaction. There are some moments in the film that I think are pretty nightmarish, even by our standards today. There are some moments. I don't know if if people are worried that this is a scary film. I don't necessarily think it is. It's not. And by our standards, it's probably not even considered a horror film, more like a thriller.
Yeah.
But there's just definitely some nightmarish and some kind of freaky moments that are just like visually just very stunning.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Adam is on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Adam.
Hello. Incredible show today. And The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is really one of my favorite films. I was wondering, given that there's such a symbiosis between music and film, Have you had the experience yourself, or do you know of a situation where rather than the film being made and the music being composed for it, whether there was a situation, I guess, where during the generation of the film, it was more collaborative with the composer.
Sounds like an interesting project, if nothing else.
Yeah, and that definitely happens. I mean, every film, I said it earlier, every film is different, every approach is different, every director and composer are different, and so there's always a different process. But yeah, I mean, generally the tradition is the film comes first and the composer scores to it, but if you could take a very famous movie of 2 years ago, Social Network, the composers wrote a lot of that music just in their studio based on clips and reading the script, and then David Fincher, the director, literally, you know, wove the music as he was editing the film. So it was a lot more of a collaborative process than the traditional method. So you'll see examples of that all throughout cinema where they didn't take a traditional approach, even though there is a definable traditional way to do it.
Speak, if you would, Richard, a little bit to the kinds of experimentation available to you as a smaller orchestra than larger ones, even in this area, might be able to do.
Well, I think that just given the economic climate, most of these larger institutions, which naturally are more, you know, they have a much stricter performance schedule. They really have to adhere to a high standard of play. They have to adhere to contractual obligations. They are not particularly nimble organizations by comparison to us, because every one of our events is a one and off thing, like I had mentioned, and so we can and considerably less expensive, just pragmatically speaking, and so we can be very risky and very bold, knowing that, you know, if we do something, and perhaps maybe on occasion if it shouldn't work out, it wouldn't be catastrophic the way it might be to perhaps an organization that has quite a lot more invested on every single event. So
Like there needs to be room for that in the art world.
Right. There definitely does. I mean, it's great for artists. I mean, I know Brian Sinigera has just been crazy about this project, composing these new scores and to these films. So it's a great opportunity for someone like him, where these things probably wouldn't happen elsewhere. Also for our musicians I had mentioned, playing with you know the Chamber Symphony, even the Torquay in the last concert, these new scores. This is stuff that won't happen unless you really carve out a niche for yourself and make it happen and be bold and be brave and do something that's not currently out there. Everything we do is so unconventional. I can't tell you, just starting up this orchestra, I cannot tell you how many people advised us, oh, well, you can't do that, you know?
And did that make you want to do it more?
Honestly, no. You know, I was conflicted through that whole process, mm-hmm. because I believed in what I wanted to bring to Dallas and what we could bring to Dallas. At the same time, I was, you know, meeting with all sorts of people, academicians, all sorts of people who were advising me, you know, in good faith what to do and what not to do. And I found myself following some advice sometimes and not following it at others, and knowing the difference and what you should jump at and what you should, you know, be cautious about. That really is the key in my mind to starting something new.
Richard McKay is artistic director and conductor of the Dallas Chamber Symphony. Brian Satterwhite is a composer who wrote the new score for the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari that the Dallas Chamber Symphony will debut, accompanied by a screening of the film tonight at the Dallas City Performance Hall. Richard and Brian, thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks. You so much. It's been great.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.